This is Rick Sampson from Physiological Reviews, and I'm pleased today for this podcast to have the four authors of a recently accepted and online manuscript on the physiology of eating, Drs. Graciela Sanchez-Watts and Alan Watts, Dr. Scott Kanowski, the three of them from University of Southern California, and Dr. Wolfgang Langhans from ETHC Zurich. It's a remarkable story, one that PRV actually has been covering now for 100 years, and there have been really a lot of advances in this field, and hopefully we can talk a little bit about those, but talk really more about where we are as a field and what we can understand from all the recent work that's gone on. I was wondering if any one of you wanted to make a comment about just how this field has really exploded in the last, say, 20 years, gone from very observational to very precise and technical work.
Well, maybe I can start on that. I think that there have been three really major aspects to this, of course. One of them was the discovery of or identification finally of leptin in the mid to the early 90s, which really galvanized a lot of the field. It provided a way to think about how adipose tissue would signal to the brain. I mean, that's a very clear development, and the consequences of that are obviously still with us in terms of the investigating behaviors. I would say the second one, and technically, of course, has been the ability for genetic targeting of particularly cellular components, not just in the brain, but widespread to the body. And that, again, has just moved the field forward enormously. And the third one is the idea of, particularly from myself and Graciela's perspective, has been developments in neuroanatomy, which have gone in parallel to certainly the genetic targeting. And that's provided new ways to look at how the brain is organized and to put the context of the sort of, if you want to think about it, the physiological mechanisms into a more brain-wide context. Actually, I would mention a fourth one, which I think is important, but maybe one we could talk about a little bit more in detail, is the idea of marrying all of this to the actual behavior of eating. And that's something I think that the field as a whole may still want to take advantage of, I think. It's something that's not being quite as well appreciated as the others.
I think in addition to this more technical and developmental level, at the more conceptual level, the field has moved from the idea that there are single factors that control something like glucostatic theory, lipostatic theory, all these things that were around when I entered that field. And by now, I guess everybody has realized that we are not dealing with these single factors or single mechanisms, but that we are dealing with a complex universe of all these different mechanisms that somehow come together and cooperate in order to control eating and to regulate the energy balance.
And along those same lines, when I started in this field, it was very hypothalamic and brainstem centric. And the field has really opened its doors in the past 15 years to studying higher order cognitive processes that regulate eating behavior. And some of the technological advances have allowed that to be fruitful because we have tools to now not just manipulate brain regions with pharmacology, but manipulate specific neuron types acutely, and not just the neuron types, but also at a circuit level analyses where we start to look at how these higher order brain regions can connect with these hypothalamic and brainstem eating networks.
I agree with you. Graciela, did you have anything to add to that?
I think, again, you know, I consider myself very lucky to have been, you know, in a career where so many things have happened in such a short time. On the advances with technology, everything from chemicals that have been developed, the techniques that have been developed, the instruments that have been developed, and all of that, we have been able to use some of it to apply in certain ways. And the idea of this paper was obviously to bring everybody's expertise into one comprehensive article, and hopefully that's what has happened.
One of the things that worked incredibly well for us as a sort of a team is that each one of us has specialists in different aspects of all of that. And it worked very well for a final article, really.
It did. And I think that's one of the strengths of this. And sort of to echo a lot of the comments that you've made, when someone who's not working in the field of ingestion or glucose homeostasis or even reward sees a manuscript like this, they're going to probably, if they read it, they're going to go, holy cow, this field has really changed since I was in school. And everything that you all have mentioned is part of that. The focus now on higher order behaviors, the ability of these technologies to identify important pathways, clarifying how peripheral systems impact decision-making in the brain, and the process of decision-making itself, the tools we now have to monitor, at least in animals, and then in the case of some of our colleagues who do human studies, to monitor brain activity under these kind of decision-making processes, really revolutionized this field.
I also think that it's revealed some of the gaps standing on this, because a lot of work that has gone on in, say, motor control or, you know, executive function and all of that has gone in sort of in parallel with the types of works that, you know, we as everyday scientists, if you wanted to put it that way, has done. So my big questions, one of the things I would suggest is an opportunity for the field to link these two together. So, for example, you know, we identified these two, what we call eating control networks, one in the hypothalamus and one down in the rhombic brain. And that the integrated information that they get from, you know, peripheral signals or from the environment more widely are all put together to be able to create some sort of signal that then biases the selection and initiation sort of motor programs to make the behavior go ahead. And I think that link between those two things is still a big opportunity to look at. I mean, we suggested that maybe the projections out of the hypothalamus through the VTA are one way that links in. But I think this is an opportunity in the field to link sort of, if you like, the control of eating behavior specifically with the motor side of things, because all the motor networks are invoked by lots of different mechanisms for very different behaviors. So how is that bias turned into a signal which then the animal can use to evoke eating behavior? So I think that's a gap, I think, that really is just there to be investigated.
And I'm very glad when I saw your manuscript that you spent some time in the very beginning talking about the behavioral aspect and related it to the human behaviors, because it's too easy with the ballooning literature, particularly papers using the most novel chemogenetic and optogenetic approaches, to get focused on circuitry. But you have to keep an eye on how this all interrelates to the volition and the actual accomplishment of a task. And you also brought in, I know this is something that Scott's very interested in, the idea of memories and reward component. Ellen, you did mention the VTA and these pathways. I think this is really important part of anyone working in the field is going to have to deal with this issue.
This is it. And it's sort of interesting, I think, on the other side of the fence, if you like, the people who are involved with motor control mechanisms. And there's some phenomenally good work done in that field. But the hypothalamus is sort of, it's an almost like a just an adjunct on the side. There's really not a lot of...
Don't treat my favorite area so poorly.
So I think, as I said, linking these two things together, there's a real opportunity, I think, to understand not just eating as a motivated behavior, but lots of other motivated behaviors as well, because they're all going to use sort of similar mechanisms to engage the motor system.
Yeah, and I think that the structure of our review took into consideration the behavior throughout the entire paper,
really,
because it's focused on what happens before preprandial, prandial, and postprandial. And we really focused on eating as a behavior. And when you do that, concepts like memory and motivation have to be invoked, because eating is typically a volitional behavior, and we have to do some kind of foraging or decision-making process that gets us to the food. And I think the way we framed the review allowed us to really expand on that part of it.
One of our hopes, if you like, is that having people read and this review and knowing where we're coming from, that it will encourage a much wider appreciation of behavior as a very complex, temporally ordered sequence of events, rather than just simply concentrating on the sort of food intake over set times, because that really only tells you a small part of what's really going on.
Well, that was a unifying theme from the beginning, that we wanted to do that, what Scott just said. Wanted to make the point that, you know, measuring 24-hour food intake in a mouse or in a rat has nothing to do with behavior, or not much to do with behavior.
That's right.
A result of the behavior, but it's not the behavior.
You've just hit one of the points in the field is the ability now to continuously monitor the behaviors, whether they be the actual ingestive behavior or the foraging or the consumatory behavior itself, and relate that to human conditions, I think has really changed the way people who think more in terms of neurotransmitter systems, et cetera, made them think more about, well, wait a minute, how do I analyze the results I'm getting when I upregulate or downregulate one of these individual pathways?
Yeah, and I think also, again, it's an opportunity, given the technological advances that we talked about a few minutes ago, to begin to think about applying those to the more complex aspects of eating behavior, not just the consumption.
And I think the tools allow us to do that now with the advances in calcium imaging, where we can now record from specific cell types and specific brain regions when the animals are freely behaving. And this is something that's a relatively recent technological advance that's already transforming the field.
Absolutely. I'd also like us to spend a little time talking about what I think is one of the more difficult aspects of the physiology of eating. When I look at the number of factors that can affect all these various behaviors that are involved in, quote, eating, unquote, and the multiple pathways and neural systems involved, I like to take it down to a single cell level and say, yes, it's wonderful. You can activate a certain cell that you've identified because it makes one thing. But the cell certainly makes more than one thing. And when you activate it or you knock it out, you're also taking out all these cooperativities that are there. This is something our lab struggles with, and I'm sure everybody does. But the issue becomes, how are we going to put it all back together again from single systems? Certainly, there's not, at least I don't think there's one magic bullet that does all this. And trying to get the temporal sequences is really a difficult thing.
On that point, Rick, I think that the pharmacological approach that was used for many decades shouldn't be overlooked in light of these new technological advances, because it's very much complementary. In this case, you target a single peptide receptor system versus, as you were pointing out, when we target neuron types, those neurons are producing other things. And I think that the pharmacology shouldn't be forgotten in light of all these new technologies that allow us to play with these circuits.
I think personally that the pharmacology is just opening the door. It just tells you, well, this thing's involved somehow. Now people who have more modern or more unique approaches are going to have to put it into that alphabet that controls everything. As I tell the students, there's probably over 150 neural factors, be they peptides or amines, that if you put them in the right place in brain, an animal's going to show a behavior and it's going to be related to eating or cardiovascular control or something. That brings me to another point, is these pathways are important not only in the single behavior of eating and everything that goes with it, but when you activate these pathways, you're getting all these other physiologic responses like arousal or autonomics or neuroendocrine changes. And it's true that 100 years ago, people were talking about homeostasis. They were coming up with these words and these terms. And we're right back there again, because when you do one thing to an animal or a person, all these systems are going to be involved. So how do we match those into the eating equation?
I mean, I think one way to approach it is to not think about a particular region as being only involved with eating behaviors. I mean, an example of that would be the arcuate nucleus, which in our field, that's all everybody concentrates on. There's a lot of parallel work in reproduction showing that the arcuate nucleus is in fact very much involved with, for example, controlling pulsatile luteinizing hormone secretion. It's got projections and connections with the preoptic area that are involved with nest building. Mm-hmm. And, these types of things. So I think if you end up sort of taking a more broader approach, you're going to get a better context for putting the more specific results from eating. And you get that into, and then you get the larger appreciation of how these things are really starting to get together. The ventromedial nucleus is another example of that, which is very much involved with agonistic behaviors and predator and conspecific interactions.
Right.
But yet it's a metabolic sensor. It measures glucose, it measures leptin, and all of those things are involved not so much with, say, with eating behavior, but more providing the reproductive side of things with information about energetics. You know, are you ready to mate? Are you ready to deal with a predator or something? You know, so I think that's something that would be, hopefully will be helpful to the field to begin this broader context.
And I'll expand that to peptide systems as well. We have our favorite peptide systems that potently regulate eating behavior, but they also promote memory function, for example. And these two functions don't have to be disconnected. You know, there's an evolutionary advantage to learning about eating related behaviors. And I think if we take a more broad spectrum approach, not just for brain regions, but for peptide systems, I think we might get a deeper understanding of what they're doing.
Well, that's exactly, of course, the point what makes pharmacologic approaches difficult.
Right.
Because if you try to play around with one of those peptides, then you do not only influence eating or energy balance, you influence other things as well.
That's true. And it's for people who do the work that we do, that's always a concern. And that's why we try and build into our armamentarium as many of the behavior and other assays as we can, because it's one thing to see an animal eat, but if they're running wildly around the cage or if their blood pressure has gone through the roof, it's not going to be a very good therapeutic target. Well, that takes me to the idea of all of the work that we do is because we're interested, we like doing what we're doing. But of course, the brass ring is to really understand how it all works and maybe find a way to develop a therapeutic that would help people who have dysregulated behaviors like eating. And of course, there are many of those. For all of you, what's your thought of how do we get to a point where, I know we're not going to develop a magic pill, but how are we going to get to a point where we can translate this wonderful explosion of research that's occurring in animals, in rodents particularly, to the clinical setting?
I'm not sure that there's certainly not a simple answer to that. I don't know. I mean, we were talking a little earlier about the sort of the rumonabant story from, you know, a few years back where, you know, you target in the endocannabinoid system, and it seemed, you know, the idea of having a drug or an agent that will suppress feeding all looked very nice until, you know, you actually started to use the clinical trials and looking at, and then what's happening, of course, is that it's engaging other systems. Yeah, I mean the reward system, if you want to call it that. And I think it's somewhat difficult. But I mean, on the positive side, I mean, there are these strategies now using sort of dual approaches involving, for example, the glucagon receptor and the GLP-1 system, which offer some promise. So definitely not going to be an easy answer. And I don't know how long it would take to get there. I mean, you know, what we tried to do in the review was just to give almost a snapshot, if you like, of where the field is now and how maybe to think somewhat differently about the brain networks and what have you that's involved with it. So, you know, maybe that's going to give us a clue as to where to target therapeutically.
It's really a tough question, but it's one that the lay public really wants an answer to. I know my wife asks me every day, how come you haven't figured out this pill yet? My answer is, well, it's a little more complicated than I want to describe right now. That doesn't do me any good at home, but it's the same. Well, so because we have a time limit here, I wanted to kind of look at the future. Maybe we could start with Graciela. Where do you think this field is going to go in the future, in the immediate future and in the long range, for us to learn more about physiology of eating, but also get to that translational point?
I think it's going to take quite a while to get to the translational point. I hope that there will be, you know, carry on with advances, speedy advances these days. And ultimately, I think humans and animals are such complicated beings. We don't have one answer, and we are unlikely, at least in my opinion, in my lifetime, to find the one pill that will either make us lose weight or gain weight, depending on who we are, or make animals eat more or less, because it's very, very complex. So many things.
I think
eating.
The two of us have worked together a lot on basically, you know, coming from a neuroanatomical perspective, and I think that that's one of the big step forwards we've both seen, Matt, on that. And then the developments that can come out of that, I think, would be
yeah
Wolfgang.
I guess it needs a combination of something almost like cognitive behavioral therapy on one hand, combined with a few substances that may complement each other or whatever. And I mean, there are approaches like that. If you think of the GLP-1 receptor agonists and stuff like that, and Alan mentioned, you know, combination, or these days amylin and certain other agonists.
Right.
But together with this cognitive behavioral approach, that people realize it's not just to take a pill and that will solve every problem, that it takes more than that.
Yeah, and I agree with Wolfgang. And I think the fact that every one of us has this in our pocket is actually going to help. There's all kinds of smart apps being developed for cognitive approaches to weight loss and to reduce eating. And I don't think we have the data on a lot of these approaches yet because it is so new. Mm-hmm. But the idea that we can combine this kind of easy to access cognitive control mechanism with a pharmacological approach, I think could be at least one avenue in the future to help reduce caloric intake.
There's no question that the more we learn about the physiology of eating and the control of glucose homeostasis, these fields sort of merge. Advances that have come from the people who focus more on diabetes and disaltered, dysregulated glucose homeostasis have played very well into the hands of people working on ingestive behaviors, and not just food, but also other forms of ingestion. And then it's clear that drugs that are being developed, particularly these bifunctional cogeners, that are being developed for control of autonomic system function are finding a place in behavioral paradigms like eating. So it really is a convergence. And I think we've gotten to a point now where the term homeostasis can be added the term integrative, because all these systems are going to have some common players and nodal points where they intersect. Any final thoughts?
So, I mean, maybe I could just make one point that surprised me as we went through the literature on all of this. And that was, you know, we get quite a bit of thought to this idea of homeostasis. And we made a distinction between control and regulation. And, you know, sort of if you're going to use that model to try to understand what's going on in the brain, so somewhere there has to be a regulated variable that all of these control systems work into. And the thing that really I actually enjoyed sort of figuring and trying to understand is the idea of ATP availability being the absolute apex variable, control value, a regulated variable on this. And that, you know, we sort of went into the work of Mark Friedman and Graham Hardy on AMP kinase. And those were real sort of revelations to me, at least anyway. And once you sort of took that model, a lot of stuff fell around that. And fell into place. So I think that this was something that really guided our thoughts on all of this. And if you build those models around that type of thing, you know, what is a sensor and what exactly is being regulated, if you like, then that I think can inform approaches to lots of other behaviors or functions within the brain. So I think that this is that was something that really helped us formulate this whole story.